From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale, down by Great America.
Sunset District.
In between Cupertino and Saratoga.
San Jose.
Oakland.
Antioch.
Half Moon Bay.
Yeah, same here, Half Moon Bay.
Today on the show, we're thinking small. Really small.
It's really about flying less and living with less.
Just how small?
California allows a minimum amount of living space down to 150 square feet.
Sometimes even very small things can mean a lot to the people who have them.
I would see him drive by because of being in the same neighborhood. He'd drive by and his car was loaded with stuff all the time, you know. He's kind of nodding, hello, you know, how you doing? So.
You may want to come in a little closer for today's Cross Currents. Stay with us. We already know that San Francisco's housing market is tight.
How many people asked to pay over what you were asking?
Eight people. Eight people asked, and I said no. Also, two, in addition to two people, they asked to prepay it for a year. And I said no.
At open houses like that one, competition is fierce because there just aren't enough apartments to go around. A new city regulation hopes to make some more room in the market, though, by giving individual renters less room. Soon, current and aspiring San Franciscans will be able to live in micro apartments, boxes of just 220 square feet each. City Supervisor Scott Weiner wrote the legislation making these hutches habitable. He talked about them with Cross Currents executive editor Ben Trefney.
We have a housing affordability crisis in San Francisco. We're to the point where one-bedroom apartments are going for often $3,000 a month or more. Even studios are often going for $2,000 or $2,500 a month. And we're getting to the point, and in fact, we're at the point where we are pricing out a lot of people from the city, people who can't come here, people who live here and if they lose their apartment may not be able to stay here or may be forced into a roommate situation when they've lived alone for many years. So we need to have a flexible housing policy to address the needs of all of our residents. And that includes building family size housing. It also means building smaller units, particularly since almost 40% of San Franciscans live alone. So the legislation will allow for smaller efficiency studios, smaller studios, to a minimum of 220 square feet. Our current minimum is closer to 300 square feet. So the legislation would allow for a minimum of 150 square feet of living space plus a kitchen space, a private bathroom, and a closet for a total of 220 square feet.
Where'd you get the concept to come up with apartments that size that when you brought up this legislation?
Well, this is the state minimum. California allows a minimum amount of living space down to 150 square feet, and San Francisco's minimum was higher than that. And so the legislation took us down to the state minimum.
And are there other cities that have, I mean, San Francisco evidently did not allow apartments that were this size before this legislation passed. Are there other cities that are doing this as well? Los Angeles, do they allow it, for example?
Well, San Jose is at this size as well. A few others, I believe Santa Maria and Arcata, Seattle has been allowing units around this size or even smaller. And New York City, of course, has always had very small units. But to be very clear, even though San Francisco has not allowed individual studios of this size before, we do have many, many living spaces of this size, many micro units in the form of roommate situations. We all know a lot of people where you have a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment with maybe 6 or 8 people living in there, 1 or 2 person to a very small living space, bedroom, maybe no living room because it's been converted to a bedroom, and then those 6 or 8 people share a kitchen and share a bathroom. Here, they would have what the equivalent of a large bedroom space with their own private bathroom, private kitchen, and in my view, people should be able to choose whether they live in a roommate situation or whether they live in a small unit by themselves.
Did you have any concerns when you're bringing up this legislation about unit being so small or maybe changing the whole marketplace and the value of different apartments in the city?
I think that those concerns are overblown. This is not going to be some sort of dominant form of housing in the city. I think it'll serve some very specific purposes. For example, we have a great need for new student housing, and this will be, we already know of projects for student housing that we're very excited about being able to build at this size. Senior housing, where you have small living spaces with big common areas, that's another great opportunity for units at this size. Transition age youth housing at this size makes a lot of sense, and there were affordable housing providers who were very supportive of the legislation for that reason. And then I think there will be some market rate units at this size. But, you know, it has to meet the market demand. And there are some people who just will not live in a unit of this size. I know people who have come up to me on the street and said, I would love to live in a unit of that size. I don't have a lot of stuff, and I don't need anything bigger.
So do you think tiny apartments are good for San Francisco? And would you live in one? Come on, be honest. Leave your message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Some of you may be wondering if you could live with a lot less space. For others, 220 square feet is more than enough.
When you look at events like the housing bust, which eventually caused a worldwide economic downturn, you know, people were being forced into more house than they could afford.
When Jay Schaefer says more house, he means it literally, as in those houses were just too big. Schaefer owns the Tumbleweed Tiny House Company based in Sonoma.
The banks wouldn't give loans for houses that were small. People were not allowed by their local codes to live in small houses. These things are really very much a part of what caused this economic downturn. And yet nobody talks about it.
In recent years, Schaefer's become the face of the tiny house movement. It's a diverse spectrum of people who live in houses that are so small, they're often illegal. Yes, there is such thing as a house that's legally too small. So what's driven these people into such tiny quarters? KALW's John Atkinson explains in this piece from our archives.
Walt Whitman wrote that a man is not a whole and complete man unless he owns a house and the ground it stands on. I'm thinking of those words as I pull up in Grayton for a tour of Jay Schaefer's latest tiny house. It's just 7 by 14 feet, so small it violates current housing codes. That's one of the reasons it's mounted on a trailer bed. Housing regulations are really extensive, but trailer regulations are practically non-existent.
Stepping right inside the front door, to the left side, we've got the kitchen, which is very small, just about 4.5 or maybe 4 feet long. To the right side of the front door, there is the bathroom, which is probably the smallest full bath in the world, as far as I know anyway.
Schaefer's a practice salesman. He's given Oprah Winfrey and Anderson Cooper similar tours. The New Yorker calls him the brainy misfit behind the tiny house trend. And he's definitely the closest thing the movement has to a celebrity.
Which is about 8 feet by 6.5 feet wide.
Schaefer often says there's something luxurious about living simply. It frees you up to do what you actually enjoy, since you're not constantly working to pay for a lot of stuff you can't afford.
It's really about buying less and living with less. Living just with what you need to be happy rather than a bunch of extra stuff.
So there's a philosophical reason to go small. But for others,
it's more a pragmatic solution to economic and personal need than it is a change in lifestyle of now I don't want so much.
That's Stephen Marshall. He owns a business in Petaluma called Little House on the Trailer.
I get a fair amount of walk-in traffic because we're sitting here on the highway in a used car lot. So people notice and they stop, and everybody's sort of enchanted by the idea.
Marshall says that when many of these people come through, they talk about trying to use less or be green.
That's all the idealistic narrative around little houses. None of those people, not one of those people, out of, say, 30 houses that we've sold now, has been a buyer.
His clients are more practical. Many of them buy his houses for their elderly parents. That's where economics kicks in. On average, you'll pay about $2,500 a month to move your parents into an assisted living facility. But for around $6,000, Marshall will build you a little house, and you can park your parents in the backyard and take care of them yourself. Marshall's clients aren't worrying about saving the world. They want their immediate needs met at the best price.
Sort of reminiscent of a little ship's cabin, and I'll close the door, and it's nice and airtight and cozy and warm. And you look up here, we got a skylight.
Bill Glancing built a tiny house in his backyard in San Francisco's Bernal Heights neighborhood. One of his sons had moved home after graduating from UCLA. He kept sending out resumes but couldn't find a job. At the same time, Glancing's younger son also decided to move home from Davis.
And I was not about to say, well, you know, too bad, you're old enough, you know, go out and get a job or something, because, you know, it really wasn't a viable solution. You know, I'm not going to turn my sons out in the street, but we needed more room.
Glancing's main house is already pretty small by many people's standards. It's 1,000 square feet. He built his backyard cabana himself for somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000. It's an addition, a guest house. But others are actually moving full-time into smaller places.
Okay, picture this.
That's Brenda Daughtry. She and her partner, Cece Reinhardt, recently moved into an Airstream, one of those vaguely retro Silver Bullet-type trailers. To do so, they've had to downsize to meet strict limits. Their overall weight can't be more than 15,000 pounds.
We come back from being weighed. We bring in the scale, and we start putting stuff on the scale. Okay, that's 3 pounds of wool curtain that's coming out. Okay, write it down. That's an extra pair of scissors and a pot and a pan. That's 8 pounds. Take it out.
So we shaved 88 pounds in 2 hours, and we are very proud.
It's not a tiny house. They'd like one of those in a few years, maybe. But they're definitely engaging in some tiny living. The trailer is 25 feet long, 160 square feet.
I mean, it took us living in excess many years, kind of the California dream, what we thought we were supposed to have. We each had a car, you know, we had a big house. It took several years of that, and then looking at our bank account each month and our savings account each month and our Roth each month and our retirement each month and going, you know, this isn't exactly where we want to go.
Slowly, they started to downsize. They got rid of things they hadn't used in a year and sold their big house to rent a smaller place. They're debt-free now and have begun to save money.
I think it was a bit of a, you know, a kick to my ego to actually admit that I don't need all this stuff and this stuff isn't what you thought the stuff would bring you.
Talking to Reinhardt and Daughtry, it strikes me that their reasons for downsizing have a lot in common with Henry David Thoreau's. In the 1840s, he moved into his own tiny house, an experience he described in Walden, where he wrote that the cost of a thing is the amount of life which is required to be exchanged for it, immediately or in the long run. How does my stuff influence the life that I live? How much of my life will I spend paying for that stuff? And how do I actually feel about that? These are the questions tiny housers are asking. They're big ones, and have to do with the meaning of life itself. So it makes sense that, to answer them, these people have started by rethinking the places they live. For Cross Currents, I'm John Atkinson.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky.
So how much square footage do you live in, and is it enough? Join the discussion on our Facebook page. We're KALW News.
And a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
For some people, living in a tiny space isn't an option, it's just reality. In this next piece, Roman Mars takes us to the most densely populated place that's ever existed in the world, Kowloon Walled City.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. The densest city of all time didn't begin as a city, but as a fort on the Kowloon Peninsula. The idea was that the British would maintain jurisdiction over the fort to keep tabs on British-controlled Hong Kong. But over time, the fort became abandoned, leaving a 100 by 200 meter legal gray zone controlled by neither the Chinese nor the British.
That land came to be called Kowloon Walled City. And even though the walls eventually came down, its name was still appropriate. There was no mistaking the boundaries between it and the rest of Hong Kong. The edges became a wall of 13-story high-rises overlooking a comparatively sparse squatter's village.
That's my friend Nick Vanderkolk from the program Love and Radio.
Buildings evolved organically, growing tendrils of bridges, pipes, and wires that encroached on other buildings until the city turned into a single giant organism.
With about 33,000 people living in an area half the size of a baseball field, Kowloon Walled City was 46 times denser than Manhattan is today.
If Manhattan wanted to get anywhere close to that kind of density, every man, woman, and child living in Texas would have to move there.
I came across it very much by accident. I came around one corner and saw this structure that looked really different than everything else around it.
That's Greg Gerard, a photographer. He lived in Hong Kong in the 80s and 90s.
And that's when I first became aware of the Walled City and started photographing there. Its density was immediately apparent. Buildings had been built up against each other without any space between them. I went for a first walk into one of the alleys and was immediately struck by what's overhead, and that's this tangle of electrical wires and wet garbage that had been thrown from the upper floors. TV antennas all over the place. Incredible noises from the various manufacturing, metalwork, small kind of foundries, cotton mills, kitchens, furnaces burning for barbecuing pork or duck or whatever. Sensations underfoot as you go down some alleys, you know, into watery, squishy stuff.
Watery, squishy stuff?
Yeah, I mean, you know, stuff between buildings that you're walking on. I mean, I really don't even know what some of it was. All manner of sensory assault, really.
Greg took a lot of photographs of the Walled City. There's one, probably one of my favorites of his, of a temple. It's much shorter than the 13-story high-rises around it.
Over the temple is this huge metal grate that's there to keep trash off the roof.
The lifestyle of living in the Walled City was to dispose of garbage by throwing it out your window.
And so the temple built a big net above its roof, and then it actually cast beautiful shadow through all this trash.
It allowed for a really interesting light to filter down through some of the bases in the garbage, almost like a tropical kind of canopy, except this one was made of refuse.
That new voice you heard is Aaron Tan.
Aaron is an architect from Hong Kong and wrote his master's thesis about the Walled City. And he interviewed a lot of people who lived there.
But by the time Aaron was conducting his research in the Walled City, plans to dismantle it had already been formed. The city had gained a reputation as a kind of den of iniquity. The Chinese and British governments decided to evict everyone and tear it down. But it serves as a valuable lesson in how an extremely dense urban community that was surprisingly functional can self-organize without any planning or governance.
We are not saying that this is a wonderful place. We are not trying to say that we want to duplicate this model because its existence is so unique position in history. You cannot recreate it. But on the other hand, when you look at it, it has a certain quality in its performance as an urbanism. It's a kind of good alternative model for us to evaluate our design strategy.
This 99% Invisible was produced by Nick Vanderkolk, Sam Greenspan, and me, Roman Mars. It's a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco. We are distributed by PRX, the public radio exchange, at prx.org. Amazing pictures of Kowloon Walled City at 99%invisible.org.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The places we spend time in are important. They often define important parts of our lives and ourselves. All week, we're bringing you profiles of places that matter to people around the Bay as part of our community storytelling project, Here, Here. In this next piece, reporter Panina Eilberg-Schwartz takes us to a place that only springs up once a week.
I've been a customer at the Saturday Alamini Farmers Market for years, and when I found out that the same dirt lot, the one that's filled with vegetables and flowers on Saturdays, is turned into a flea market on Sundays, I decided I had to go. I really love librarians and collectors and people who see the value in things that most like wouldn't think twice about, you know, things like vintage license plates, toys from the 1930s, musical instruments from the Philippines. And, you know, the Alamini Flea Market, I heard, was a good place to look for people like that. The thing about the market, though, is that you never know what you're going to find, even if you know exactly what it is you're looking for. And this place, even with all the change of new people coming through and goods changing hands, has become an important site of community for people. One man,
Anthony James Daher, Tony to my friends,
told me a story that is about community, but also the importance of asking where things come from. I spotted a music box on his table, and he told me the story of how it got there.
It's a very heavy brass piano, handmade before, but or hand, what would you call it, cast, you know, in a mold. The song, I'm not sure, it might be like One Summer Night or something like that. I can't remember what the name of the song is. The guys, these old flea market dealers that used to live on the hill over there in my neighborhood, Vienna Street, they're actually, their home address is the same as mine, only two blocks up. Well, coming to the flea market and selling, this is 10 years ago, you know, being a newbie, and I guess he just introduced himself to me, probably. He was like a lot of these people that go through and they buy things from other people in the morning. So it's something that he was doing. And I would see him drive by because of being in the same neighborhood. He'd drive by and his car was loaded with stuff all the time, you know. And just kind of nodding, hello, you know, how you doing? So Joe Rodriguez was his name. Passed away in a fire. And this came from his sister. And a lot of this came from his sister. His clocks, because I knew him, they allowed me to have as much of the stuff that I wanted that they weren't going to keep. It was very sweet of her giving all this stuff to me, so I appreciated it. And, thank you, Joe.
That piece was brought to us by Penina Eilberg-Schwartz. And by the way, that song is actually called Around the World by Victor Young. So what's a place that's important to you? Tell us using our online recording tool. Just go to hearhere.kalw.org and click participate. We'll show you how to do the rest there. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for a small note about something that had a big effect on us. Back in December, we ran a story about Uber, the app that matches users to the closest town car or taxi cab. Uber gets its money by charging its own rates, which can be way above a typical meter.
It was 8 minutes from the time I pulled out my phone to the time my Uber car showed up. Half an hour later, I arrived at the 16th and Mission BART station in style. $50 worth of style, actually.
Listener and taxi driver advocate Mark Gruberg said we missed something, that regular cabs are using apps already and without the extra cost.
Next message.
One significant thing that was left out is that the taxi industry is now using the same kind of app that you find on Uber. Services like Tabulous and Taxi Magic put you directly in touch with a driver from your cell phone. The driver picks you up and charges you a taxi rate and not an Uber rate, which is approximately 70% higher than taxis at best. And then because they use surge pricing, it can be astronomically higher at the busy time.
End of message.
We asked Isabel Angel, who reported the original story on Uber, if she had anything to add.
Okay, so here's the deal with Cabulous. It's now called Flywheel, and it works a lot like Uber. It's the same idea of using an app to match the passenger to the closest cab. But here's where it's different. Unlike Uber, Flywheel doesn't mess with the meter. They just take 60 cents from the driver off each Flywheel-generated cab ride. You can either pay the driver in the car or use the app, like Uber. A third of SF cabs use the app. That's about 580 cabs. So right now, I have the app pulled up on my phone, and I can see all the cabs using Flywheel around San Francisco. Currently, they're mostly centered around downtown, the Mission, and the Marina, with one lonely cab in the inner Sunset. So maybe I would have to trek back to the outer Richmond to see if it really stands up to the test.
If you've got something to say about one of our stories, we're all ears. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. I'm up on the 11th floor and I'm watching the cruisers below. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Isabel Angel, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Alyssa Kapnick, RTM's Konahovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Eva Sonsin, Anna Sterling, and RJ Sloan. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. I am on a honk hunt! I am on a honk hunt! You're listening to the Oakland garage band known as Shannon and the Clams. They'll be part of the program at The Parkside in San Francisco tomorrow night. The sound assault starts about 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.